My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio, and you are listening to Sound On. Earlier today, I was at the State Department, and I spoke for an exclusive television and radio interview with the Undersecretary for Economic Affairs, Keith Kroc, and I asked him point blank about the importance that the administration feels on diversifying the supply chain from China. Take a listen to what he told me.
It's critical to diversify that supply chain, and I think we're seeing that right now with the pandemic. And so this is an effort that we've been doing for the last couple years, and now it's being turbocharged because of that pandemic. And I think a lot of it's brought on by citizens around the world realizing some of the things that's going on with the Communist Party of China. And I think the president did a great job of waking up the United States, but I think everybody's sees China's, what I would affectionately call their three-pronged strategy of concealment, co-option, and coercion. So if you look at the virus, the pandemic is a result of the concealment of that virus. If you look at their face masks, their so-called face mask diplomacy, where they are seducing, coercing countries to do things and using that PPE as collateral. And then the third thing is, I think people have woken up and they see that China has co-opted a lot of the economies by entangling supply chains. So it's critical for national security as well as economic security.
Let me follow up on that face mask diplomacy. Are you concerned that China might be dangling PPE to our U.S. allies to really try to get them to get even more entangled in 5G network?
By the way, I think we're seeing that around the world. And it's a classic part of their three-pronged strategy. Yeah. I think understanding the dangers of 5G from an untrusted vendor. And Secretary Pompeo announced on April 29th the Clean Path Program, which basically calls for any network traffic coming in and out of diplomatic facilities, whether it's here or abroad, all our embassies, it requires a clean path. So in other words, it's trusted, it's reliable. It cannot have touched, for example, a Huawei antenna. And we expect other countries and companies to make those same requirements.
Before we come back to domestic politics, sticking with international, this economic prosperity network, how important is that the U.S. developed that, not just with U.S.-based companies, but also internationally?
Yeah. So if you look at the economic prosperity network, it's core to our economic security strategy. There's three pillars in that. The first one is turbocharge economic competitiveness. The second is safeguard America's assets. The third one is the economic prosperity network. And what that means is forming an alliance, a network with trusted partners. And so the economic prosperity network is comprised of like-minded countries, companies, and civil society for all areas of economic collaboration and in all industries. So digital, energy, infrastructure, even money flows, education, research, logistics, supply chains is a key part of that. And the key is that this economic prosperity network operate by a set of trust standards, things that we would call American values here in the U.S. In Europe, they call them democratic values, and probably the best international translation is trust principles. And those are things like accountability, integrity, transparency, reciprocity, respect for rule of law, respect for property of all kinds, respect for sovereignty of nations, respect for the planet, respect for labor. And I think this is what the world has been asking for. And I've probably had about 60 bilateral meetings over the last year in terms of different countries, economic ministers, foreign ministers, finance ministers. And this really resonates. And they want America to lead. They go, we need America to lead.
Keith, how do you do that, though, when several of our allies have already formed relationships with China, with Huawei, on 5G?
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that China is a big trading partner, and a lot of countries, their number one trading partner. But for these countries, it all comes down to one word, and it's trust. And by the way, you know, coming from the business sector my entire career, trust is the basis of every relationship, business-wise, personal or otherwise. And when you talk to these government officials, or even when you talk to companies, international companies, it's that issue of trust comes up with China. And I think what has really accelerated this is what's happened in the pandemic, because I think people really understand that this should have never happened.
And meanwhile, domestically, the State Department has also been trying to do new significant outreach pertaining to economic security strategy to make sure that the U.S. supply systems, both from technologies, from energy and other sectors, are better protected against economic threats. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, because, you know, one of those core pillars for the economic security strategy is safeguard American assets. So that's...
And what does that look like? Because people hear that thrown around.
So here's what it looks like. So first of all, it's intellectual property. It's technology. It's supply chains. It's financial systems. And a lot of people don't realize of the 150-some Chinese stocks that are listed on the New York and NASDAQ stock exchange, they don't have to do Sarbanes-Oxley, which means go through big scrutiny in terms of audit. And they can't be audited. And for a guy who's taken four companies public, you know, personally, maybe I have a problem with that, but I'm thinking of the shareholders. And because that lack of transparency is not good. You know, the other key assets to safeguard is our education system, our healthcare system, all those kind of things. And that's why not only are we looking at it from a supply chain standpoint, but we're also looking at in terms of Chinese investment and our CFIUS process as well.
You know, just a final question. I want to come back to this point of face mask diplomacy and the concern that I hear from you, that I hear from Democrats, Republicans alike on Capitol Hill about China dangling face masks and PPE to U.S. allies.
Yeah.
And the potential for that happening on U.S. supply chains if that is so entangled. That's got to worry you.
Yeah. And by the way, I think... if you look at this China issue, this is probably the most unifying bipartisan issue ever. I mean, everybody has a passion for that. And, you know, it's Chinese doctrine. It's not just deception, but it's also seduce with money and reinforce with intimidation and retaliation, right? I mean, we all saw what happened to the general manager of the Houston Rockets when he just did a seven-word tweet. Within 24 hours, $100 million of sponsorships were dropped by Chinese apparel companies. Now, that just doesn't happen by accident. That's a playbook, because that has to go to the top, and even the government of China can't move that fast. So I think this is on the minds of our Congress, our executive branch, our judicial branch. I think it's on the minds of companies. We could really see that when I hosted Secretary Pompeo out in Silicon Valley for 4 days. I hosted 36 of the top CEOs in my home, and as they went around the room, we had them tell their China story, and they were kind of frightening. But and we see the same thing in other countries. I did the same thing with a set of 25 German CEOs. You've got to be in a closed-door setting because all these guys are afraid of retaliation. And I think our stance, an important role for America, is there is strength and power in leadership in terms of unity and solidarity. And this is where the economic prosperity network is key, because it creates a network of alliance under these trust principles. And this pandemic, you know, is such a horrible thing. But if there's any byproduct out of that, I think it will set the table for the future with the economic prosperity network.
That was Keith Kroc, the Undersecretary for Economic Affairs, speaking to me earlier today from the State Department in an interview, wide-ranging interview about how the State Department is looking to diversify the supply chain from the United States and China, and the network of standards that they're trying to implement with allies, particularly in Europe, as it relates to 5G. And of course, I had to get in some NBA basketball in there as well. My name is Kevin Cirilli, and I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. And coming up later on in the program, we're going to actually check in with the founder and CEO of Cafe Milano, which starts curbside pickup, an iconic D.C. restaurant. Franco Nusquese is going to join us live here on Bloomberg Sound On. But first, I want to check in, and this was a segment that I've wanted to do for a while, with David Chavern. He's the president and CEO of the News Media Alliance. David, are you there?
Yes, I am. Kevin, thanks very much for having me.
Anytime, anytime. You know, we've been talking about this in the Bloomberg newsroom, virtually, of course, about the importance of local news and how COVID-19 has really just shown a spotlight on the importance of local news, local blogs, local websites, because that's how a lot of people are getting their information right now, these trusted local outlets, whether it's on television, whether it's on radio or in print. And you are fighting this five-front war, essentially, right now. Tell me about
it. Yes. Yeah, well, it's an interesting point you made. You know, we had gotten used to what I call the nationalization of news attention, people paying relatively more attention to national and general interest stories than, say, our parents would have. But in this moment, it turns out when you have a real crisis that everybody, the telescope spins around and that people are intensely focused about local. Where's the COVID cases? Where do I get tested? You know, what's the shelter in place order? And it really shows the importance of a local news ecosystem really when you need it the most. And basically, we've been working on two broad things. One, helping the industry get through COVID-19 crisis. And this gets into stimulus issues and being essential workers and the rest. But we've also been fighting a kind of long-term battle about getting more value back from Google and Facebook and the digital ecosystem to support the business long-term.
So I think this is fascinating because, especially from a local news media perspective, David Chavern's on the line. You've spent something like 30 years in executive, strategic, and operational roles. You also had you previously at the Chamber of Commerce served as executive vice president and chief operating officer for the Chamber of Commerce from 2007 to 2014. We talk a lot about small town journalism, Main Street journalism. But who owns those news sources is crucially important. And you just alluded to Google and Facebook in particular and how that information and unfortunately sometimes misinformation gets spread on these platforms. What are you guys doing to prevent that from happening? And how do we make sure that Silicon Valley isn't tilting the scale in favor of a negative influence?
Yeah, it's interesting. People still think about the industry in terms of the print product, you know, the physical newspaper, which is still a great product, by the way. A lot of people use it, but the vast majority of our audience is digital, and obviously that's increasing all the time. And, you know, my basic message to Silicon Valley has always been, listen, if you have a fake news problem, guess what? We're in the real news business. We're the antidote for that problem. And so we need to have a sustainable business arrangement with you where our content is distributed primarily now through Google and Facebook, and we get very little value back. And that's not a sustainable model. And by the way, as we become more and more digital, it also means that the business becomes harder and harder all the time. So if for the next crisis, not only this crisis, but for the next one, if we want to have a strong local news, local journalism, we're going to need to get value back from the big tech platforms if we hope to sustain ourselves.
So you and I have talked about this offline. David Chavern, who is president and CEO of News Media Alliance, which is the news industry's largest trade organization, and it's not necessarily, folks, when you think of corporate media, what he represents is all of the small town America's newspapers, digital resources, and whatnot. There's legislation that has been making its way on Capitol Hill, bipartisan, mind you, bipartisan legislation. Give me an update on where that stands. I know it's probably on pause because of COVID, but tell me about where that stands.
Yeah, this bill, which again has Amy as co-sponsors, just a few of them, by the way, Amy Klobuchar, John Kennedy, Mitch McConnell is a co-sponsor, David Cicilline in the House, Doug Collins, you know, very bipartisan.
Yeah, very bipartisan.
What it would do is would allow the news publishers to come together and collectively bargain with Google and Facebook for a better deal. Weirdly, the current antitrust laws protect Google and Facebook from us, weirdly and ironically. And so this is basically what allow us to come together and negotiate as a group to get a better deal. And a better deal is about money. It's about data. It's about algorithms. But, to basically have a chance to fight for our future.
And just a couple more questions here, David. How much of a threat are foreign governments? You know, earlier on in the program, I had the Undersecretary for Economic Affairs at the State Department, Keith Krock, on in an exclusive interview. And he was talking about or alluding to the misinformation campaigns from China, for example. And it's been widely reported in the past several weeks about how China has launched their own the Communist Party of China has launched their own misinformation campaigns on their own social media platforms. How important is it to protect the integrity of local news from these horrific misinformation campaigns?
Tremendously. First of all, people are used to thinking about, foreign interference and disinformation as being just about national issues. But what we see is that they dig in and create controversies at a local level. So you need a good local journalism voice to respond. Also, one of the complaints we have, actually, but first of all, Google and Facebook, I complain about them a lot, but they're tremendous distribution systems, but they don't make it a sustainable way to publish news. And one of the reasons is they tend to suppress the brands. People see a flood of information through their news feed or, through a social feed. And where the information come from gets suppressed. And so people aren't trained or they've forgotten at some level how much you have to pay attention to the origin of the content. And, again, my members' content is an answer for disinformation, but we also need to work hard to make sure people understand where the news is coming from and not just to believe something because it shows up in your news feed.
David Chavern, I think that's fascinating, especially that point about how bad actors are actually even penetrating on a local level, folks. I mean, that to me that says it all. David Chavern, he's the president and CEO of the News Media Alliance, giving us an update on the important work that the organization's doing, bipartisan work that they're doing to protect the integrity of local news. Thank you, David. You're welcome back anytime. I want to pivot now to go back to foreign policy because Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is going to travel to Israel this week. And that means we have to check in with Matt Brooks. He's a Republican strategist and the executive director of the Republican Jewish Coalition. Matt, thank you for calling in. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Kev. How you doing?
Good. Can't complain. It's finally warming up a little, Well, now I'm looking out my window, and actually the gust of wind just took out one of my lawn chairs. But too much information. Enough about me. But Secretary Pompeo is traveling to Israel. This is, I believe, his first trip abroad since this has happened, since all of this has gone down. Why is it so important that he's traveling to Israel, and what does that show about the importance of the U.S.-Israeli alliance?
Well, first of all, I do think it's important that, especially with all the hotspots and all the difficulties around the world, the Secretary of State felt it important enough to travel to Israel, both to, I think, congratulate and formally begin to work with the newly installed government in Israel. And I think that, this is coming in at a very, very important time as we do now have a government. We have leadership in Israel. I believe that the president and the Secretary of State and Prime Minister Netanyahu all want to try and get movement on the Trump peace initiative. And I think everybody realizes that, we have a ticking time. We have a ticking clock as it relates to the elections in November. So we don't really have a lot of opportunity to sort of drag our feet. So I think that the Secretary is going over there to work with the new government and to hopefully continue to move the Trump vision for peace in the Middle East forward.
So, it is fascinating how foreign policy obviously is not on pause, but foreign policy and geopolitics has had to adjust, just like businesses and politics and everything in the world has had to recalibrate in wake of COVID-19. Here is Israel with a new government, and now this peace plan that was rolled out a couple months ago, and you're still saying that it could still get worked on, even as Israel and Palestine are, like the rest of the world, on lockdown.
Yeah, no, it has to be. And Israel's starting to, you know, they're a little ahead of us in terms of opening things up. They took a much more draconian approach to mitigating the impacts of COVID in Israel and literally shut everything down very early on. They're now just starting to loosen things up, get back into the swing of things, and we'll see how that goes over there. But, you know, they did a remarkable job at limiting the number of COVID cases and COVID fatalities in Israel, certainly disproportionately on a per capita basis, much, much better than any other industrialized first world country did.
All right, let's pivot back to domestic politics, because this everyone politically and conservative blogs and liberal blogs are talking about how the president's really asking some new questions for former President Barack Obama. How is this going to play and shape the 2020 closing political arguments? I would imagine it's going to be a massive issue in the debates.
There's no question. Obviously, you know, the reality is that I think we're going to try and paint Joe Biden as an extension and a continuation, a third term of Barack Obama, certainly as it relates to Israel and the foreign policy. That's the case that we're going to make, because the sharp contrast between President Trump and Barack Obama as it related to U.S.-Israel relations couldn't be starker. But domestically as well, and the stuff that has now been coming out and the revelations about the involvement of senior members of the administration in trying to entrap and cover up the actions of the FBI in terms of using it as a political tool are just very, very troubling. But, you know, Kevin, at the end of the day, you know, Donald Trump isn't running against Joe Biden. Donald Trump's opponent in this election is the coronavirus.
Yeah, no, and so is Joe Biden's, right? I mean, they're both, in a way, going to have to run against this. This is, without question, going to be a populist election. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I think that's exactly correct. And so the real question is going to be, you know, who's the best person to lead this country out of this economic crisis and reignite and restart the economic engine? And there's no question, after 3 years of unbelievably historic growth and unprecedented job creation,
yeah,
that I think a lot of people are going to look to Trump as the doer, as the guy who can get things done and bring us out of this.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good contrast with Biden.
Matt Brooks, it's always great to catch up with you. Go get yourself a cheesesteak. All right, Matt?
Save me a Tony Luke's.
I know. I got them. I got enough Tony Luke's to last me till the end of the year. Tony, my brother Tony back in Philly, he's South Philly. He sent me a bunch. I was homesick. I said, Tony, I want some cheesesteaks. He said, I got you covered, brother. And now everyone's like, where do I get the cheesesteaks, you know? Matt Brooks, Republican strategist and executive director of the Republican Jewish Coalition. Always down for a hoagie or a cheesesteak. I'm Kevin Cirilli, chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and Radio. And you're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. I just got off the phone with my dad because I had to do some prep for this next interview with Franco Nuschese, who's the founder and owner of Cafe Milano. And I said I couldn't interview the iconic Franco, the founder and owner of the equally as iconic Cafe Milano, based in Washington, D.C., in Georgetown, if I didn't know what part of Italy my ancestors are from. Abruzzi, I'm told. And I checked in with my Aunt Adeline as well. We're from Abruzzi, off the coast, Franco. And you've got some big news, buddy. You guys are opening up curbside tonight, aren't you?
Yes, we indeed are, Kevin.
Okay.
Keep in mind that Abruzzi is the place where the best chefs are coming from. They say that, you know, being close to the sea and close to the mountain, they are able to put together always a lot of great dishes.
I love that. I love that, because I am a big fan of Italian.
But I'm from the Amalfi Coast, I wanted to remind you, and our chef is from Tuscany.
All right. Well, you know, hey, More Italians, the better. Listen, I do have a question. You guys have a new menu, curbside. You've tweaked it because I was looking at the notes you sent over to me, and you said you can't have some. You actually changed your menu for curbside so that if you do order curbside from Cafe Milano, you're still getting the Cafe Milano experience, and in a curbside way. Explain to me what's on the menu.
That's right.
So what's on
the menu? Just to let you know, I mean, the menu, all the dishes on the menu, I would say 85%, 90% of the dishes are the same that we have or that we are offering on the regular menu. But of course, with the curbside, you know, we had to modify, because the most important thing is for us is to be able to deliver quality. And we know that we are facing the challenge of the picking up. You know, we don't know how long the client is going to take to eat the food. So that plays a very big role. Sometimes we have to give it to a driver. The driver, we don't know how far he's going to take it. So it's very important that we make some small adjustment to make sure that our food can travel. You know, the Italian food, our menu, our concept, most of the menu doesn't really travel well. So we have to just adjust it and make sure that we will pick with the chef, that we will pick dishes that they will stay well, that would travel well.
I love that. I love that, because that just speaks to how you're taking, you know, even pride in curbside, and you're not just going to get, you know, mush when you order curbside from Milano. You're going to get the full Milano experience in a curbside box. I love that. Frankenus Kese is on the line. He's the CEO and owner of Cafe Milano, which is an iconic DC restaurant. I actually, at your anniversary party, Franco, I met Michael Jordan. I shook Michael Jordan's hand right there at Cafe Milano. I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
But I heard that you're having. Let me ask you, how has the shutdown impacted your business, Franco?
Well, you know, the biggest issue, you know, first of all, you know, it is the busiest season of the year for us. Between the months of March, the middle of March, and the middle of June, is those 3 months are pretty much the best quarters that we have here, due to the fact that we have a lot of events, a lot of delegation coming from out of town, and of course a lot of graduation for the month of May. But the biggest issue right now is the uncertainty that we don't know when we're going to be able to open. We don't know what the restriction they're going to be. How will be the public react? And what happens if there's going to be some new cases or infection? Right after we open. You know, we will be doing everything imaginable to make Cafe Milano a safe place, and no matter what, at what cost. This is no longer a story of trying to save money during this difficult time. For me, this is really that I will spend most of the time to make sure that the people are very, very happy, and most of all, safe.
Franco, I got to ask this difficult question. If this keeps going on, how much longer can Cafe Milano survive before it has to make a difficult decision of shutting down?
This is an important question, very, very important, very interesting question. Now, the thing is this, that we will see how long it's going to take for the mayor to decide. And I understand that she does, she needs to look after, she has a safest science and safest first. You know, we could go, we will see if it's going to take another month. It might take a couple months. And the fact, Kevin, that even if we're going to open in June, or let's say the first week in July, that really doesn't really mean much. We have to prepare ourselves for at least 6 months to have 50% of our business. And we will do the best to keep it. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of negotiation. You know, with the landlord, for example, you know, we just have to make sure that we are all having a long vision, because that's the only way that we can succeed. We've been here 27 years, as you know, and we will definitely try and give the best that we can. But we just have to work together. And after all, I don't think there will be too many banks or investors giving money to restaurants in the next few years.
So you're telling me that
you're
telling me there's a possibility that Cafe Milano might have to shut down if there's no reopenings in the next couple of months.
Well, that could be a possibility, but we don't know. We don't know.
Wow.
We hope that's not the case. But at the end of the day, we want to be able to protect also our employees and our future employees.
Let me ask you.
It's not going to happen in 2 months from now. At least if it's 2 months later, we still want to be here and have a job for them.
Franco, have you been able to get PPP? Have you applied? What have you heard on PPP?
Yes, we have applied and we are very close to here. Yes, of course, that took long, long time, Kevin, because the first time, as you all know, they ran out of money. I'm assuming there were so many applications, but the bank has informed us that we should hear it very, very shortly. But the PPP loan concept is very good only in theory. Under these current guidelines and conditions, it doesn't work for every important group like the restaurant. I have to tell you, take the adventure today, we will have to pay staff while staying at home, which is a waste of the government money. And it doesn't put the restaurant in any better shape to face the future.
Listen, I want to ask you one more question. We've got 60 seconds left. But you're someone who is iconic to Georgetown. Your restaurant has hosted everyone. I mean, I don't even want to go through the names, everyone. Let me ask you, what are you drawing on now as your compass to navigate through this difficult time, Franco?
Well, again, it's a great question. And I have to say, he's really focusing on not only what we can do now and pay attention on a daily basis, what we can, cannot do, who we can approach, and again, trying to keep always that style, that reputation. But at the same time, looking at in the long run, 3 months from now, 4 months from now, 6 months from now, because this is something that not only myself, we all have to face that stage. And we just can't think about in the next couple of months. The idea is to see 6 months from now. The world has changed. When we're going to come back, it's not going to be 100%. We hope that is the 50%.
Yeah.
I'm hearing in some state it could be the 25%.
Yeah.
But in that case, we really need to focus how we're going to deal on the long run.
Franco Nuscese, founder and CEO of the iconic Cafe Milano, open for curbside now. Thank you, brother, for keeping me focused on the future. I'm Kevin Cirilli, chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg TV and radio, and you're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.